KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening hour of Forum, we'll talk with two of the three authors of a book all about China's youth culture, which the authors call The Culture of Cool, and the world's fastest growing market. Lian Yu and Cynthia Chan will be joining us for an hour, which will include your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Of China's population of 1.3 billion, 640 million are under the age of 30, and some 200 million are teens or young adults between the ages of 15 and 19. Since the 1970s, when its borders had opened to U.S. tourists, China and its youth culture have gone through remarkable changes economically as well as culturally. A trio of ethnographers, researchers, and business people, Lian Yu and Cynthia Chan and Christopher Ireland, have put together a book all about China's new culture of cool, as they describe it, designed to help us understand the rapid changes that have occurred among China's youth, which they describe as the world's fastest growing market, because that indeed is what it is. Lian Yu and Cynthia Chan are with us in studio this morning. We welcome both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you both here. And let's talk about these trendsetters, this new highly courted group of consumers, 200 million in China. It's really, in some ways, perhaps Mao Zedong's nightmare in many respects. And certainly, he never would have imagined. Let me begin with you, Cynthia Chan. What I guess we describe in Mandarin as, I'll use your last name here, Zhong Chan, middle class. This is the rise of the middle class, isn't it?
His opinion actually is Zhongchan in Mandarin, and it's like slightly different from my last name.
But it's spelled the same way.
It felt the same way for you.
So I'm anglicizing it. We're off to that start right away here. Let's get the right pronunciation. What is it?
Zhongchan.
Zhongchan. Okay. And a lot of this has to do with the rise of an unforeseen middle class, no?
Yes. Actually, I think this is a pretty new term that was coined in China. In the 90s. So it's a pretty new term, a very young term.
A very young term, and these are very young people we're talking about. Young, and as you describe them, Lian Yu, idealistic, refreshingly idealistic, optimistic, and happy. Quite a contrast to a program we did recently about Japanese youth who are stay-at-home and often pretty much isolated. This is a frenetic and very involved group of people we're talking about here, particularly the urban youth, not the impoverished agriculture youth, but the urban youth.
That's right. We did focus on the urban youth in places like Shanghai and Beijing. And, you know, what we really wanted to do with this book was bring the voices of these young people alive, because we know there's so much interest in China right now. People are always talking about China. But, you know, what are Chinese people really thinking? So we tried to get inside their heads and represent the world as they see it. And one thing that definitely surprised us was how optimistic they were. They weren't at all cynical about the world. And, you know, there's just so much hope and optimism about their futures and you know, what they could potentially do in the future. So definitely, as you say, it's a very different kind of youth culture than Mao Zedong would have imagined.
A lot of nationalism, too. Intense nationalism.
Indeed, a lot of pride. And I think the word nationalism might be misleading because, you know, a lot of people ask us, are these Chinese youths, are they, you know, patriotic towards the Communist Party? Are they patriotic towards communism or the state and things like that? And it's not really that. What they do is that they love China and they love the idea that their country can be just as successful and as powerful as the West. And that's really the dream they're going after. And that's what's sort of making them strive and work so hard.
I'm talking to Lian Yu, who, by the way, is a partner and strategic director of Cheskin, a consulting firm, and she specializes in ethnographic research to understand consumer behavior. In fact, this was not the China you imagined from your ancestral China, the China you heard about as a young woman. In fact, you know, having people near Tiananmen Square buying chicken from KFC and all that, and not standing out as an American, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, for me, this book came out of, well, several places. One was that my first experience in China was as an exchange student in 1990. So I was there right after Tiananmen. So I saw what life was like with students there. I was fortunate to live on Beijing University campus and to live with students there. And it was a really different time, Michael. There was just this cloud of depression over students and student life. And there wasn't the same sort of optimism we see today. And everybody was sort of writing off China, saying, well, you know, what happened in Tiananmen, it's basically pushed China back into the Stone Ages. It's never going to recover. You know, people aren't going to be able to sort of recapture the dynamism that had been in the air in the 80s when economic change was taking place. But what we see today, and it's, you know, nearly 20 years later, is a really different kind of youth culture. The sort of the politics for daily life for young people, particularly students, have sort of gone away, and there's kind of a new kind of thing they're going after, and it's very much around consumerism.
That's a dialectic, like Mao thought, just not quite what he had imagined, perhaps. Cynthia Chen is also with Cheskin. She's a strategic director and the co-author of this book that we've been talking about, China's New Culture of Cool, Understanding the World's Fastest Growing Market. And Cynthia, you come from Hong Kong, you've sort of gone through a metamorphosis as far as China's concerned, too, from doubt to awe, maybe? Would that describe it?
Sure, you know, because I was born and raised in Hong Kong while it was a British colony at that time. So when early talks about, you know, Hong Kong will be turned back over to mainland China, you know, in the early 1980s, there's a whole lot of concerns. And I have personal experiences, you know, with a family trip to Shenzhen, you know, to amusement park and all that, you know, the sanitary, you know, situation and condition were not as impressive. Customer service, non-existent. So I actually, you know, hopefully, you know, I am really happy that that didn't really detract me from going back to China, because I'm really fascinated by the fast-forwarded development right now in China.
I was, you know, being a little bit tongue-in-cheek when I said this is like a dialectic, but in many ways it is. I mean, we've gone from a kind of collectivism that we associated certainly with the communist regime under Mao to individualism. I mean, something that we associate much more with the West and with America. Individualism very strong now and passionate for Chinese youth.
It is very much so, and it's very prominent within the youth culture that we saw, I mean, in recent years especially. You know, they're not Confucius consumers anymore. They're not consumers, you know, Confucius consumers anymore and people anymore, that they're embracing individualism. And
they're
also expressing it.
The bourgeoisie and bourgeois values, that's part of it?
Yeah, that status. That status for them is really important and is a way of them showing the individualism through whatever they can achieve. And that's show in manifested in different ways, including like fashion or clothing or mobile phones included.
But a lot of this individualism is also off toward nonconformity, is it not?
Yep. Yeah, you can say that totally. And then you can see that, you know, from the Mao era, you see all these like dark green color military jackets to right now really colorful mini skirts. So you can tell.
Quite a switch. And also, a lot of this has to do, Leon Yu, I think we can assume, the competition economically and in the consumer world. I mean, you've got contemporary eclectic marketplaces and mega malls now in China, but also the kind of competition with Korea, Japan, the United States, and Europe.
Yeah, I mean, historically, as we know, China's had a very kind of love-hate relationship with Japan in particular. Just, you know, historically, a lot of bad things, as people would say, you know, happening in China, the fault of the Japanese.
Keeping the rape of Nanking under wraps.
Exactly. And for young people, at the same time, you know, they'll say they hate Japan, but at the same time, they're really fascinated with the outside world, Japan included, fascinated with, you know, what kind of new things young Japanese people are thinking, as well as Korean young people, and really engage with the media, engage with outside ideas. So there's kind of this both a competition with the outside world, wanting to be number one, you know, being nationalistic and being very proud of their country. At the same time, there's just sort of this desire to really go out and see the world, because Chinese people can travel for a very long time. And even now, it's a luxury. It's not something that most people can do, which is just cross their borders and go into another country. So really seeing the world outside and learning from that is something that we heard a lot of young people say again and again, that was their true desire and that was their passion.
Yeah, you lay a lot of emphasis on the ethos of new experiences and how important that is. But there's also, I suppose, a westernization side of this. You mentioned Korea and Japan, Cynthia Chan, but there's a tremendous influence of advertising, the consumer West, all the things that we associate with Madison Avenue and, well, the world we live in.
Totally. Celebrity endorsement all over the place. There's a slew of billboards that you could see with Asian faces, you know, when you walk down the streets in Shanghai and Beijing. And then speaking about Korean, I can talk a little bit about the Korean wave, which is a term used to describe a phenomenon in Asia, actually. And it's directly, literally translated from a Mandarin word called Hanliu, which is a Korean wave or influence. So it broadly described, the term is used to describe that whole phenomenon of how Korea took over Asia from, you know, they started from a TV drama series that was exported from Seoul, followed by a whole lot of fashion, celebrities, movie stars, LG, Samsung, everything, the whole package.
You realize there are people who are lamenting this, thinking China's lost its purity or something in its sense of non-Westernization that at one time was held high. Is religion becoming stronger too? I mean, certainly in a society like the one we're talking about, it often happens that religion begins to infiltrate, or maybe that's the wrong word, but become more present.
I wouldn't say that it's becoming more prominent, because religion has been in China for a long, long while. It's just depending on what kind of religions and what types of religion you're talking about. You know, Buddhism, Taoism is still, you know, the top two in China right now, but then more and more people may turn into churches like Christianity.
Talking, if you just joined us, with Leanne Yu and Cynthia Chan, they're both with Cheskin, a consulting firm, and they are two of the three co-authors of a book called China's New Culture of Cool, all about upwardly mobile young Chinese and the extraordinary changes that are going on in clothing and food and housing and just general mobility in China. And have we defined what cool is? Help me with the pronunciation. In Mandarin's K-U. How do you pronounce that?
Ku.
Ku. Okay. Just like Bill and Ku. have we been able to determine what is indeed ku?
We're still trying to crack the case here. Cool is a very new term in China. Again, it's a very new concept yet to be defined. We try to define it in different ways. I think right now it's like whatever is non-conforming, whatever is leading the trend, that's cool.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's really interesting about this concept of cool is that, you know, for young people in China, you know, we can say there's a generation gap everywhere around the world, that people rebel against their parents or the generation before. But I think one thing that's really interesting to keep in mind here is just how great the gap is between parents and young people in China today. If we think about parents in China, people in their 40s and 50s, they grew up, you know, sometimes affected really a lot by the Cultural Revolution and under Mao's regime, and just really discouraged from individualism, discouraged from consumerism, discouraged from any kind of show of difference or uniqueness. So for young people today, you know, they're looking for the sense of cool, but they don't really have models to do so. They don't have, you know, anybody to guide them. So they're really trying to forge this path on their own.
The shift in generations is so dramatic. I couldn't help thinking, we had the Mao Zedong's biographers on, and they talk about how Mao was ready to starve millions to death in order to get nuclear weaponry. And now we have not only fast food all across China, but again, pronunciation, Xi, S-H-I? I got that right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, okay. Obviously, my Chinese is wanting terribly, but there's a sense that they're trying to experiment with all kinds of cosmopolitan foods and different kinds of fashions from so many different countries. It's like, I mean, China has become extraordinarily cosmopolitan. That's probably the only word to use.
Yeah, I think food is an extraordinary area in which young Chinese are really trying to explore and do new things. We did a project recently just trying to bring a fast food chain into China, and we heard over and over again from young people as well as parents of young children that for them, restaurants represent a window to the world. You know, because again, most of them can't travel. They don't have the funds. Even if they're middle class in China, it's really hard for them to travel. So restaurants actually represent kind of peering into another sort of lifestyle, different ways of thinking. And restaurants, actually, Western ones in particular, and sometimes are stages for young people to express themselves in different ways as they would in Chinese restaurants. We heard one young man recently say that he feels really comfortable holding hands with his girlfriend and kissing her in McDonald's, which is something he would never do in a Chinese restaurant. So McDonald's for him is that. It's a place where he can really fully express the new him.
There's also a kind of revolution going on in terms of beauty. I mean, Botox has come to China, plastic surgery, and these young people are looking toward those kinds of things as options, just like young people here who begin to get in their late 20s, 30s, and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, that's actually part of that exploration and adventurism that they are experiencing, or they try to go after. Is, you know, part of the trend that what they want to embrace, and also part of it is the newness that attracted them and appealed to them, because this is something new that I can try. You know, this is, you know, what I saw that, you know, people in Korea are doing, people are in U.S. are doing. You know, why can't we do it and try it as well?
Talking again about China's new culture of cool, understanding the world's fastest growing market and understanding just the changing nature of that market and how things have changed rapidly and will continue to change. The speed of change is almost too much to keep up with. It's so volatile, and the future is, as the authors point out in their book, almost impossible to guess. But one thing that's not changing is credit cards. Everything's still done with cash for the most part, isn't it?
Yeah, the credit system is still underdeveloped in China compared to in the U.S., so a lot of things are cash on delivery. But that is changing, actually, and a lot of that is being pushed by online shopping, the fact that so many people are starting to really live on the Internet, and, you know, that's certainly an area that we see changing a lot, just the Internet really being truly that kind of free public space for young
Chinese.
Well,
is it entirely free, though?
No, that's true. It's not entirely free. But again, that's our perception of what it is. And so for the young Chinese that we talk to, their perception is that, yeah, okay, there are things we can't necessarily do, but we have workarounds. We know how to find the things that we want to find.
Are they more mindful of things like China's human rights violations or the selling of weaponry to and support of nations that perhaps are looked at in the world as not being in the interest of global harmony and things of that sort? I mean, how mindful are they of the kinds of things that I'm talking about?
Well, quite frankly, these are not the things that young people have top of mind. They're not thinking about their country in those terms. You know, we tried to sort of let them express what was really important for them. They're thinking about Bill Gates. They're thinking about entrepreneurialism. They're thinking about, you know,
money and what it can do for
money,
you.
Money, exactly. Money, what it can do for us.
And also about, as you mentioned, Cynthia, the celebrity culture, and they're tuned into TV and the Internet now in so many ways.
Right.
But all of this carries a cost with it. I mean, AIDS is going up in China because of the freedom of sexuality. There is more pollution now than ever before because of all the automobiles. The SUV is big in China. I mean, many costs to pay.
Yeah, definitely a lot. But then I think the government is actually paying more attention on the pollution, you know, situation and environmental issues as well.
But they don't feel this sense of repression from government, the government in interfering in their lives and keeping them from being free and independent?
I don't think they see it as an interference. I think lately, you know, because we've been talking to, you know, the young people, you know, in China lately and recently in the past few years that we have been doing work over there. And I think they welcome it. They welcome it as a good sign that the government is actually helping them and assisting them.
How do they look back on the Cultural Revolution?
The Cultural Revolution, actually, I'm not sure whether they seriously, the young people are like putting it behind their back, thinking that, okay, we're into this new era right now, and we're seeing China becoming a stronger power in the global stage. So we're, you know, we're not too worried about what had happened before. But then, you know, we're looking for it with the country.
Well, and also one thing we found is the reality is a lot of their parents don't want to talk about it with them. You know, the memories of the Cultural Revolution are really painful for those who really experienced it at its worst. And
we talked before about how the Rape of Nanking is not in Japanese textbooks. Is there a good deal about the Cultural Revolution in Chinese historical textbooks? Do you know?
Not much. I mean, again, sort of the way people are educated around the period of Mao was, you know, there were some mistakes that were made, but for the most part, he sowed the seeds for what China is today. So,
and it's still worshipped and lionized in many ways, isn't it?
Well, not in places like Shanghai and Beijing. I mean, probably in some more rural areas where there's just been less exposure to Western media or things like that. There's probably still a sense that Mao is still relevant and alive, but not for the young people we talked with.
Well, you mentioned Shanghai. Peter Kaufman, a local filmmaker, made a film about Shanghai a number of years ago, and I was struck even then by all the clubs and all the plate watering holes and places to dance. Does the older generation look upon some of this as just decadence? I mean, particularly since they came up in the Mao way?
I think they're flabbergasted. They're completely they don't know what to do with all of this, and that's part of the sort of generation gap with the younger people. They're looking at this and they somehow want to participate, but they don't know how. And just to give you an example, one area is in cosmetics. So for younger women, they're just completely seeing a lot of ads, as you said, about, you know, facial things, Botox, all of that, and they're participating in that as much as they can.
Traditional things like paler skin, too. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Paler skin, it's definitely made a huge comeback, and there's a huge cosmetics industry around that as well. But for older women, there's not this sense of connection to all of this. They want to somehow be part of it, but how they can connect in is still difficult for them. So really, women and men who are 40 and over, they're really kind of an untapped market right now in China.
Talking with Leon Yu and Cynthia Chan, both of Cheskin, and it's a consulting firm, and two of the three authors of China's New Culture, A Cool, Understanding the World's Fastest Growing Market. One of the things you point out in your book that's, I think, important to highlight here is there's a myth of a kind of homogenous youth culture. And yet, even though we're talking about, in general ways, this youth culture covers a pretty broad panoply.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a total myth, I mean, to identify any, you know, huge culture or group of people in a homogenous kind of way. So in the book, actually, we identify four different persona and composites of young people. So, you know, to make all these brief, I mean, we can introduce a few of them briefly. One of them is the playgirl, what we call them, a playgirl. They're the living in the moment kind of deal. They're not too worried about the future, the government, political issues, but I'm in the living in the moment. Let's have some fun. And then the other one we can introduce is the striver, which is people who work hard, play hard. I just want to achieve whatever I can to, you know, I'll climb up my career ladder and I'll make money and I'll buy all this like cars and mobile phones to show that I can do it. So, Leanne, do you want to cover the other two?
Actually, the two you've just mentioned could easily fit into Western archetypes of Western young women. And Leanne, I think the other two can too. It's kind of composite archetypal Chinese youth.
Yeah, they're not necessarily unique to China. I think what's unique here, well, one thing to keep in mind too is these young people we're talking about, they are the first generation ever in China to grow up as singletons, as children without brothers and sisters due to the one-child policy that started in 1979. So it's sort of a point of uniqueness there in that they're striving, they're doing all the things that Western kids are doing, rebelling and all of that, but they're doing it in a family structure that's completely new and completely a break from the past in China. If you imagine the traditional Chinese family, there are as many brothers and sisters as you can count, and everybody living under one roof. But for these young people, they're growing up mostly in what we'd consider nuclear families, something very new in China, away from cousins, living in apartments or houses with their mothers and fathers in these smaller units. And they're living in a time of unprecedented economic prosperity.
Which is allowing not only for more individuality, but really for more feminism, too. There's a kind of sexual politics behind this, whereas women were pretty much, if not a second or third or fourth class of citizens for a long time in China. That's changing.
Well, I think the whole issue of women and what's happening with women, it's definitely a mixed bag. You know, under the Maoist regime, women were told that they held up half of the sky and encouraged to work alongside men and to not even look different than men. You know, they would wear the same things and work in the same way. What we're seeing right now for young people in China is an extreme emphasis on looks. Women are told, you know, you're either not beautiful enough for this job, you're not tall enough, you're not thin enough, your skin's not white enough. These things are very explicit out there. There's almost a hyper-femininity happening right now with young people.
It's happening in the West, too. At the same time, the women are moving forward, one could argue here, or have moved forward, and glass ceilings are breaking. Anyway, I want to invite those of you listening to join this conversation, and you're cordially invited to do that. We've gone kind of from Mao and the Cultural Revolution to cool and materialism, and what does all that mean, and what does it mean to you? And some of you have been to China, may have some observations you want to put in here. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Lines available to you. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786 if you have questions or comments, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're looking at China's evolving urban youth culture with a couple of the authors of a book called China's New Culture, of Cool, Understanding the world's fastest growing market, Lian Yu is with us. She's a partner and strategic director with Cheskin, a consulting firm specializing in ethnographic research to understand consumer behavior. And Cynthia Chan is strategic director of Cheskin and co-author with her and Christopher Ireland of the book China's New Culture at Cool. Your phone calls are welcome, and if you'd like to join us, you can do that now, toll free at 866-733-6786 or by email. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Just talking a little bit off air about the fact that nationalism can be often, dangerous, as we've learned in the 20th century by two major wars. And Lian, you were saying, well, the nationalism is of a different strain. It's more kind of a pride in country and all that. But I was recalling when the Belgrade embassy was bombed by accident, the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, by the United States, and the Chinese youth were up in arms. I mean, they were protesting all over the mainland, and one has to ask the question, could this, especially with the competition with the West over resources, specifically and particularly oil, could a lot of this nationalism become toxic and become, you know, something to really be concerned about?
Well, the kind of fire that you see in students and the simmering of student thoughts and protests, that's something we see historically come up again and again in China, particularly, you know, times when we think that Chinese youths might, you know, be complacent and lay low. They've actually always surprised us and come up. You know, 1989 was a perfect example, as well as the bombing of the embassy. You know, the kind of passion that they approach their pride with, or national pride. But again, I think that, you know, we, coming from the U.S., we have this perspective that Chinese youths, if they're nationalistic, it must be about their government, or it must be about upholding their government. But it's really different, at least the way they express it to us. It's really about China and the great nation that it was once, and that they hope that it can be in the future, irregardless.
It's emperors and ancient China and its historical past that is being exalted in some ways, you're saying. Yeah. But what about Tiananmen Square? I mean, you know, one remembers the whole democracy movement. It was a youth movement.
Exactly.
And what's happened to it?
Well, a lot of the leaders of the Tiananmen Square movement, you know, they left China. They were forced to flee and whatnot. You know, and that was, again, you know, the kind of energy and things we saw in youth culture back then. It seems very different in China today, but again, that's a surface observation. You know, looking at young people today, one would get the impression that they're interested in are the latest Fendi bags or the latest Korean soap operas and whatnot. And the kind of political underpinnings, or that sense that they wanted to do something really good for their country, that existed, you know, in the 1980s that led up to Tiananmen, that's still there, but I think it's being expressed in different ways right now. It's definitely being expressed in blogging. I mean, blogging culture in China is humongous. It's actually the hugest blogging.
It's gone from writing on walls to writing on blogs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, they're very vocal, and like Lian said earlier, you know, they're expressing
Cynthia
things
Chan.
Through blogging, and then also through building their QQ site, which is like a MySpace site. And then they express whatever they thought, you know, their thoughts and ideas, you know, of the world, you know, on the blog and on the site.
Well, we'll bring in our callers, and we'll begin with you, John. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. I'm
interested to hear, from what I've been hearing, it sounds as if consumerism, to some degree, is a distraction in China, much the same way that it is in the U.S., you know, having all these goods available and the booming economy makes it possible to concentrate really on your own career and your own future, and not really have to think about some of these things. And I'm curious what some of your guests would think about, you know, this being a certain kind of form of government control, almost, in a way.
You mean that the materialism gets their minds off things they should be thinking about?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, we thank you for the call. Materialism as a diversion. What do you think, Cynthia, Lian?
Well, one thing that to keep in mind is that for young people in China, consumerism and materialism, these are actually really new things, you know, things that their parents didn't experience. And for their parents, materialism and these things, they were actually dangerous things to be involved in. So for young people, being involved with consumerism, buying things from Brand X or whatnot, that in itself is a form of individualism and a form of rebellion against the past as well. So again, you know, recasting it in the way that they think about it, it's not that they're these zombies. You know, they don't think of themselves as these zombies who are just buying things and being materialistic, but that engagement with stuff is really part of their desire to be unique and individual.
We've got a listener here named Michael who sends an email asking about gay life in China. What do we know about gay life in China? Still somewhat repressed, certainly, isn't it?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that was not something that we looked at very deeply, but there's definitely burgeoning gay culture in some of the bigger cities like Shanghai and so forth. But again, it's something that the government does not want to talk about. And, of course, that feeds into the problem of AIDS education and so forth.
Neil joins us. Morning, Neil.
Oh, yeah, a couple of questions. First, you mentioned the Cultural Revolution, but don't forget, before that, there was the 100 Flowers and the Great Leap Forward. I guess all of this has been kind of muddled and forgotten. Also, how about the fact that you mentioned single people? How about the sexual or the gender imbalance? That must is that having any impact? And my main question, actually, is this. The old urge to migrate, to emigrate to the United States and the other English-speaking countries, especially from provinces like Fujian, which just a few years ago was vast numbers were trying to get out and migrate. What's happened? Is that still there, or is that no longer a factor?
Good questions. Let's talk first about gender imbalance, because certainly for quite some time there was an emphasis on having boys to such a degree that there's a kind of a dearth of young women, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. And then certainly the one-child policy exacerbated that, particularly in rural areas where having a son is really important for, you know, work on the farm or, you know, actually maintaining your family property and things like that. It's led to some things like, you know, there in rural areas, there's definitely a problem of young men finding women to marry and things of that nature.
And what about the migratory patterns that Neil mentioned?
Yeah, I think I can speak from my personal experience because I'm, you know, a first generation Chinese American here. So, you know, there are still, you know, people who are trying to leave the country. I mean, we talk with so many young people and they're literally asking us, oh, if we go there, you know, with a student visa and I stay, what will happen? You know, they're interested in finding out, you know, ways of, you know, staying in other countries and why, you know, they want to do that. I mean, the motivation and underlying you know, reasons behind that, it may be, you know, there are other opportunities out there, you know, in the world for us. As they, you know, leap on the internet, you know, they see more of the world and they want to see even more. So, you know, that may be one of a big push.
But we're also seeing somewhat of a phenomenon of reverse migration. So
that too.
Overseas Chinese who've been educated or worked in Silicon Valley choosing to go back to China to start businesses or give back to the homeland.
Yeah,
safe to say that we're seeing a corporatization of China, increasing corporatization of China?
I'd say so, definitely.
Let me move along to some more of your calls. And by the way, if you'd like to join us here, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, any questions or comments you might have. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org. One of our emailers asks, is English coup? I think it's Chinese, right? It didn't, I mean, in other words, it wasn't truncated from the word cool. It's an original
Chinese
word.
Oh, no. Actually, it's spelled K-U, and it's a pinyin, which is a phonetic translation of, you know, the sound of cool in English.
But you're still trying to essentially graft what this means, what it means to be cool in China. It sounds like it's not that all that different from other westernized countries. I mean, Korea and Japan maybe as well, but for the most part, Europe and the USA, no. That's safe to say?
Yeah, I think so. But then probably, you know, on a superficial level, it may look the same. But the underlying motivations or what's pushing it, it may be very different. And how people embrace it and how it got manifested in different ways, it will be very different.
Well, what are those other two archetypes that you alluded to before, Leanne? We heard about the playgirl and the striver. What are the other two?
The other two are what we call the modern conservative. And these are people who actually are, unlike kind of striver and playgirl, they're much more interested in national life. They are the ones who would be more willing to speak out in favor of their government or at least saying, you know, that China is a good place and we want to build China and help it grow. So they're kind of more... they're not rebellious in that sense, but they really want to kind of make China grow and just do the right things. The last group that we talk about in the book is in Chinese called Ling Lei, and we call them the rule breakers, and they're really sort of out on the edge, really. The people who would be with piercings and tattoos, again, this is very highly unusual in China. But they're the ones who just want to sort of shun all authority, shun all rules, and really try to live life on their own terms.
How are they treated generally or regarded, especially by the older generation?
Oh, with a lot of suspicion, actually, the last group in particular. You know, looking different or looking in that way is still not socially acceptable. And there's, you know, kind of the sense that you represent your country. So how can you, you know, wear that or go out and look like that? You're bringing shame onto the family and onto your country.
But it's not, Cynthia, I think, as you point out in the book, it's not, excuse me, Leanne, as you point out in the book, you don't stand out when you're over there as an American like you used to.
Well, I mean, I'm third-generation Chinese-American, so I don't stand out at all. But for other Americans who go, particularly in places like Shanghai and Beijing, no, it's true. You know, there's much, people aren't going to be staring you up and down or come up and trying to touch your hair or touch the hair on your arms the way they would in rural areas and, you know, things I've seen some of my Caucasian friends experience. And, you know, we also have to remember that for these sort of middle-class rising Chinese, a lot of them are being educated in English, so they can communicate with outsiders, with foreigners in a way that, you know, previous generations could not. So there's much more sense of global communication and connectedness.
A lot of fluency? You walk through major cities in China now?
I'd say that the Chinese, compared to, say, the Japanese, and I lived in Japan for a period of time, are certainly much more willing just to put themselves out there and speak to you, you know, and not make any apologies about it.
But like, speak in English or
exactly.
Understand English, yeah.
Exactly.
Let me get Catherine on from Moraga. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi.
Hi.
Great program. I've actually wanted to ask this question, and I was kind of a little disappointed with the response, so I'll ask it a different way. I think the gender difference based on the 1979 policy probably has, I got to believe, has had a huge effect on a lot of the contents of this book, because if you have a 2 or 3 to 1 ratio of male to female, of course the females are going to want to become more feminized and you know, kind of fluff themselves up and be attractive. And I was also wondering if incidences like rape or bribe kidnapping or any other kind of sort of statistics would be borne out on having men that can't get women. I mean, they're just not around. I wonder if they could actually, if there's richer data from this than just sort of a superficial review of that dynamic.
Well, we know that the problem of bride kidnapping is actually quite a big problem, particularly on the border with Vietnam, with, you know, families or young men basically kidnapping brides from Vietnam to bring them into China because of this problem in the rural areas. You know, the kind of gender disparity that the caller is speaking about is definitely more manifest in, well, quite frankly, the base of China, you know, the 700 million people who form the base of China, not necessarily the middle class of the cities where the gender disparity is less obvious and less of an impact on people's daily lives.
Here's a listener, CL, who says, are these youth you're discussing representative of all youth, working class and poor included, or is it a minority elitist element? And that's a kind of key question. We're talking about a minority, aren't we? Urban, upcoming.
Yeah, we'll say urban youth. I mean, the book we have focuses actually on the urban youth, and rural youth obviously have a very different attitudes to life.
How many are we talking about of, say, the 200 million between the ages of 19 and 30? How many are these economically sort of Chinese yuppies, really, I guess you'd call them? Huh?
I'd say a good, you know, 50 to 60% of them we could consider in our terms yuppie, or sort of in that buying power class that allows them to get whatever they want, more or less.
And here's a listener from Oakland, Glenn, who says, we have always been taught that economic freedom will lead to free expression, then ultimately to political freedom. China seems to be allowing economic freedom without political freedom. How is this possible? Mm-hmm. If and when will political freedom come to China? Well, there's a key question, Glenn, and I don't know if any of us have the answer, but he's right about the paradox, you know?
Yeah. You know, one thing that we noticed as we were talking to the kids in China is that they tend to have less of a black and white view of things that we do here. You know, here it's like places free or not free. There's censorship or no censorship. In the Chinese context, you know, when we spend time with young people and watch them go online or watch them, you know, go about their daily lives, they perceive that their lives were very free. You know, that they could go on the internet and they could you know, find whatever information they wanted. You know, sometimes back roads, you know, sometimes in ways that weren't necessarily direct, they could go on and blog and say what they wanted to. Sometimes they had to kind of hide some of the references or be a little bit more poetic and not straightforward about what they were referring to. But they perceive that their life is very free. And I think that's kind of the key thing that we wanted to convey in the book, is that from their perception, there is a lot of freedom, at least compared to what they perceive their parents lived as. And that's sort of the starting point for thinking about, you know, what Chinese lives could be like in the future.
So when you talk about a culture of cool in China, I mean, they're watching shows, I presume, like Sex and the City. And I mean, you know, the same kinds of things on television mm-hmm. are coming across dubbed and translated into Chinese television homes. And is Americans, American culture therefore cool to them, or Americans cool to them?
Depending, probably Nike and Adidas, yes. And McDonald's and KFC, probably another yes. So
well, that's a place where you can talk to your girlfriend. We've
and
yeah,
kiss her.
Yeah, you can hang out there with your date. But then, you know, there are other things, you know, in you know, obviously within the Asian regional cultures, there's a whole lot of influence on China as well versus, you know, everything Western. So, I mean, there's a myth that we want to showcase, is like not everything American is lovable in China.
And on we go to more of your calls. Josh, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. I was actually wondering if there was a concern about the environment, about global warming amongst the youth culture in China.
What do you detect on that score, Leanne or Cynthia?
It's growing, actually. It's actually come up more in the last, I'd say, half a year. We've seen billboards in China. Clearly government-sponsored, warning people about, you know, the dangers of pollution. And a lot of this is actually pushed, quite frankly, by the upcoming 2008 Olympics. China wants to put its best face forward towards the rest of the world. It wants to be accepted as, you know, responsible government, a responsible nation. And so a lot of these things we're seeing, concern with the environment, concern with, you know, AIDS and the AIDS epidemic, health issues and all of that, these are very much actually being pushed by this fear, actually, that the government has, that they're not going to be accepted by the world come 2008.
But it's coming from the government rather than from the youth themselves.
It is. It's being pushed now by the government. But it is we see some grassroots coming forth.
Let me thank you, Josh, for bringing that up. China has a couple of the most polluted cities in the world, of course, and big uphill battle there. John, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I had a question about the book Mao's War on the Environment that came out about 5 or 6 years ago. I've often wondered, is it any are there any people in China that have actually read that book, and are the youth aware of it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call. What do we know about youth awareness?
I'm not sure. I don't know if anybody in China has read that book. We do know that sometimes books are copied and sold illegally in China, so wouldn't be surprising if there are copies of it on the black market. But in terms of sort of youth political life, a lot of that, again, is getting back to the blogs and kind of the information about, for example, SARS, things going on in the news and whatnot. A lot of that is spread not really through traditional media forms like the news and so forth, which is very much propagandist, but through SMS, through blogging, through word of mouth. So it's really through these social networks of young people that information is growing and spreading.
Yeah, so technology actually is playing a major role as providing people as a convenient platform for them to voice opinions and be vocal.
A couple of emails here that are provocative in some ways. David says, Michael's and the caller's questions have revolved around political issues, censorship, repression, Mao, some of the monumental historical events, and so on. Having lived in a number of Chinese cities myself, I know that these issues are the furthest thing from most Chinese people's minds, especially young people. Can the authors comment on the American press's failure to present an accurate picture of modern Chinese life to Americans?
Well, that, quite frankly, that was the whole impetus for our book, China's New Culture of Cool, and that, you know, there is a lot of talk about China right now, China and the trade imbalance, China and the WTO, the Olympics.
I just did a show last week on the Ties That Bind report from the Global Economic Forum.
Exactly. Fact, yeah. A lot of people interested in China for doing business and whatnot, but again, we weren't seeing out there a lot of really the voices of young Chinese people and how they saw their world. So all of these issues around censorship, repression, democracy, we wanted to really kind of see them from the inside out and see how young people themselves express themselves. And like the caller said, a lot of these things are the first furthest things from their minds.
Yeah, the emphasis ultimately in your book is on clothing, food, housing, and mobility. Mm-hmm. And in fact, here's another listener who says, are there useful comparisons of China's current transformation to what the U.S. underwent in the 1920s? The U.S. became urbanized, massive demographic change, mobile via cars, a consumer culture via Madison Avenue, but we were still culturally insular for popular culture. Had recently had a civil war, were overwhelmingly religious. Other comparisons might lead to predictions. Well, maybe so. Let me get another call on here, and that's you, Tom. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Sorry I came into the show late, but apropos of the last caller saying, you know, why this paradox? Why is China economically free but politically not free? I think we need to dispel that misconception because fundamentally, if you look at the facts on the ground, China is not economically free. And by China's own admission, if you look at the Chinese labor bulletin published by some labor dissidents in Hong Kong, in China where, you know, labor organizers, independent of the government, are beaten regularly. There are some 60,000 disturbances, it's a euphemism the government uses, in last year alone, and it's increasing by the year. And that's because there are some, I think the estimate is 200 million itinerant workers, migrants inside China, people who are displaced, evicted en masse by force. Usually with thugs hired by the government. You know, if we look at the facts on the ground, you cannot say with any seriousness that there is economic freedom in China. We cannot just look at the top 1% elite in China. China is a nation of 1 billion people.
Some response from our authors to the statement of Tom.
I would agree with with the caller in that, you know, the book is very much about the rising middle class in China, and it is not meant to be representative of all of China. It's about kind of the top tier of the pyramid. And we focused on that just because, you know, young people in China and sort of how they're defining their future, we thought that, you know, they'd be sort of interesting voices to look at. But, you know, I have a lot of empathy for what the caller was talking about. You know, when I lived in China in 1990, it was a very repressive time for students. They couldn't even be seen with a foreigner without having to go through a lot of paperwork and have to sign in and, you know, sometimes pay a penalty for being seen in an area that they weren't supposed to be seen in. So there's definitely still that underlying repression, and that's part of the reality of life in China.
And Tom, we thank you for the call. The repression created a whole kind of intertwined network. I mean, you write about this in the book, and it's fascinating how during Mao, particularly, there was a use of connections all the time. And that is ongoing. That continues.
That is ongoing.
Endures.
It is. It's like we always call it guanxi, which is network in English. And we're talking about like networking in China is really important because in Chinese culture, we're very people-oriented. We're very social-oriented. So if you have a strong network, a group of networks that is strong enough to support you and whatever you want to do, you can headway.
Is it a similar network to the one that existed under Mao, though? I mean, the same kind of structure or hierarchy?
Hierarchy and structure maybe is the same, but if we want to focus on the youth population and how youth actually built the social network, I mean, the platform they use is via technology and the internet and all that. So the ways of achieving that network is slightly different from before, which is more face-to-face building of the relationship.
Now, we've got the two of you here. We don't have your fellow author, the woman whose name is Christopher Ireland. Yeah, I love that name for a woman. She was hoping that the Chinese were going to be producing flying cars because since the fourth grade, I think about that Bruce Willis film. anything to lead us along those lines? is that up ahead?
Well, one thing that definitely is true of China, and this breaks some of the myths that people have about China, is that they're definitely innovators when it comes to technology. Anyone who visits China sees that their cell phones are actually much better looking and much smaller and much more advanced than the ones we have here. And as, you know, one of your guests pointed out in your last show, you know, a lot of the biggest technology R&D companies, you know, they're in China right now. If we think about the Microsoft and Motorola and Intel and whatnot, there's really a lot of innovation, a lot of design there, particularly in the technology area. So wouldn't be surprised if flying cars came first out of China and that they were cheap.
Here's a listener who says, your two guests keep mentioning nationalists or being proud. I was wondering what exactly Chinese people are proud about. Why are Western culture and lifestyle so attractive to them? Why are students not learning traditional characters?
No, they are actually, you know, I think this modernity and traditional culture doesn't really have to be a clash. It can live, you know, in a balanced harmony together, which we're actually seeing. You know, not that people are all you know, westernized and all that and forget about their roots and culture, but they're also, you know, blending traditional cultures into, you know, their modern life. I mean, one classic example we can pull is, you know, from personal care and creams and whatever, more and more Chinese domestic brands are coming up with cosmetic and personal care products that has a true herbal or traditional Chinese herbal medicine in their ingredients, but packaged in a very scientific, with a scientific approach.
Still acupuncture, still all kinds of things that certainly go back to ancient times. Here's a listener who says, I had to chuckle when I heard the guests talk about Westerners not being stared at in Beijing. I'm a Chinese-American married to a man who is a little mix of everything. When we walked around Beijing with our daughter a couple months ago, we were stared at constantly. People would actually stop and stare as we walked by. Westerners might be a more common sight now, but mixed families are obviously a novelty.
I would agree with the listener that mixed families are definitely still a novelty in China. And I think there's a lot of fascination in particular with children. So children who are not don't look like one thing or another, you know, they get a lot of attention in China.
Seeing a lot fewer bikes, though, aren't you?
Yes.
In the big city.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we'll continue, obviously, to watch these changes that go on in China. As the authors warn in their book, it's a speed with which it's pretty difficult to keep up with. Changes so fast that it's almost impossible to guess, but you may want to avail yourself of their book. It's called China's New Culture of Cool, Understanding the World's Fastest Growing Market. And two of the co-authors, Leanne Yu and Cynthia Chan, who are both with Cheskin, a consulting firm, have been with us this morning. Appreciate very much your being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And remind you that another hour of Forum is coming up, and in the hour ahead, we're going to talk with a journalist and a broadcaster for the BBC and a sociologist, Anna Karp, who has written a book all about the human voice, as we shift gears again and remind you that we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Always welcome hearing from you about what you hear and what you'd like to hear. Again, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or call our listener call-in line at 415-553-3300. Want to extend thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.